You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you I have not had the honor of meeting, my name is John Allen. I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all today to our event, How Congress Can Support the Middle Class America. Today's convening is the fourth part of our latest event series entitled A New Contract for the Middle Class. One of our flagship efforts from the Brookings Future of the Middle Class Initiative, which is led by our senior fellow and the director of the initiative, Dr. Richard Reeves. Launched in 2018, this initiative has featured a diverse set of voices from across all levels of government, including now President Joe Biden, who spoke at our launch event. At the time, he described the moment that we're living in as, quote, an inflection point, where the decisions that we make in the next several years are going to say an awful lot about the kind of life our children and our grandchildren are going to be leading, unquote. He also pointed out that, quote, the reason for our social and political stability is in no small part because we have had a strong, aspiring, and growing middle class, unquote. 3 years later, his words could not be more relevant. Over 2020 and these early months of 2021, we've seen the American middle class struggle to overcome a deadly pandemic that has wreaked havoc on and has created crisis and chaos within the labor market. And furthermore, Black Americans, many of the middle class, have continued to face racial injustice and police brutality all over the country. And truly, the need for justice for all of our communities of color remains more pressing than ever. It is in times of crisis that we look for our country's leaders to show us a way forward, not just for the sake of the present, but as in the case of the COVID-19 pandemic, to show us the far future, to create a long-term social and political stability so desperately needed for our society today. So far, there are indications that this future may, in fact, be drawing closer. Recently, Congress passed the new stimulus package that provides much needed relief for our low and middle income families, including a child tax credit that provides $300 a month and guaranteed income for families with children for the next year. But what happens next? We are still in a moment of crisis, to be sure, yet we also can consider and prepare for what will happen for the middle class once the pandemic is over. Congress will need to think about infrastructure improvements and changes to education and worker training to create a stable and thriving middle class emerging from this crisis. Only time will tell how these many critical issues will end up and how we will address them in the coming months and years. Now, turning back to today's event, however, we are most fortunate to have one of the leading voices on these issues with us today, Senator Mark Warner. Representing his home state of Virginia, thank you, Senator Warner, my senator, he has dedicated his life to serving the American people. A member of several Senate committees, including most notably the Committee on Finance, the Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, and the Committee on the Budget, Senator Warner is a stalwart champion of the American middle class. Now, soon he will provide us his perspective on what the Congress has been doing and what their plans are going forward on these topics. We begin to see light, potentially, at the end of the tunnel of this long pandemic. So thank you, Senator Warner, for joining us today. We're really honored to have you with us. Now, joining the senator is senior fellow Camille Doucette, who is the director of our Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative and a member of the steering group of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative. She'll be moderating this timely and important conversation with the senator. Before I turn the floor over to Camille, a brief reminder that we're live and very much on the record, and should audience members want to submit questions, they can do so to events@brookings.edu, that's events@brookings.edu, or via Twitter using #MiddleClassMonitor, #MiddleClassMonitor. So with that, let me turn the floor over to Camille, and thank you again, Senator, for joining us. Over to you, Camille.
Thank you, John, and welcome, Senator. It's wonderful to have you here, and we're delighted that you could join us for this very important conversation about what the future will look like for the middle class, particularly as we begin to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. I wanted to pause for a moment to recognize the loss of life last week as Americans who aspired to the middle class were gunned down in Atlanta massage salons, and to just let everyone know that Brookings definitely is with you and recognizes that important and very devastating loss of life. So, Senator Warner, I know that you have a set of proposals to help the working class that go much beyond the stimulus package. I wanted you to tell us a little bit about that, your thinking about that, and then afterwards we will engage in a spirited question and answer session, which will largely be driven by our online audience. I want to remind viewers that they can submit questions on Twitter using the hashtag Middle Class Monitor or by emailing events@brookings.edu. So, Senator Warner, off on to you.
Well, Camille, thank you, and thanks to Brookings for holding this forum. And let me say at the outset, both, I appreciate you acknowledging the tragedy that took place last week in Atlanta and how that is, again, reflective particularly of the enormous growth of anti-Asian American violence and rhetoric in our country. Let me also say that I commend Brookings for the very good work that you all have done on this project over the last couple of years, reviewed your proposals, the vast majority of which I agree with. And I think this issue is so critically important. I come at it as somebody who is the proud product of the middle class, and reflecting back on my life, it almost seems like if there was a picture drawn of what a middle class kid could aspire to in the latter half of the 20th century, I might fit that bill. My dad was a Marine in World War II. He came back, and my mom, our family started in lower middle class in Indiana, moved to Illinois, Connecticut, ultimately ended up in Virginia, public schools all my life. I was the first person in my family to graduate from college, got through with student debt, but not enough to be debilitating. I went off to law school, started business, failed miserably twice in business until a third try in the beginnings of the cell phone industry back in the 1980s. And I ended up being successful beyond my dreams. I was able to do that because my dad worked for 38 years for the same company where he didn't make a lot of money. But with that job came a set of a social contract in terms of benefits, retirement, health care. If he'd lost a job, unemployment, and he got hurt, workers' comp. It came from public schools that were good. It came from a higher education system that was still relatively cheap in the 1970s when I went. And it came from the fact that as a white guy with the appropriate education, I got more than my share of fair shots. I'm very aware of the fact that I've not been a white male with the right education, as I probably wouldn't have gotten three shots at entrepreneurship. I would have been lucky to get one. And I think we've seen in the last 70 years a hollowing out of a lot of those opportunities. And that hollowing out has been obviously exacerbated by the COVID pandemic. So I want to touch briefly, so we can have as much time as possible for our conversation, on some work that I've been working on over literally the last 4.5 years to really rethink how do we recreate that opportunity economy? How do we actually even go more deeply and look at our system of capitalism? And I say this as somebody who's benefited from American capitalism, but how do we make capitalism work for more people? I start that and the first point I want to raise, and I think the Brookings has done some work on this as well, is acknowledging that the nature of work has changed. For much of the 20th century, when people went to work, they went to work long-term, as did my dad, and worked at that same firm for the balance of their career. A firm would then make investments in that worker to rise them up, even if they were simply a worker on the line. Starting in the early 90s and exacerbating by the spread of globalization, that social contract started to fray. And increasingly, all work that was not critical to a corporate's bottom line was outsourced, either literally in terms of jobs being sent abroad, or figuratively as work, janitorial work or food service work or other non-service work was taken away from the corporate umbrella and moved into consulting type arrangements. I think it's time for us to acknowledge that we're probably not going to go back to a traditional 40-hour a week work forever for the same firm kind of economy. Matter of fact, that move to outsourcing has been accelerated by gig work. Sometimes work that is by choice, oftentimes by economic necessity. And I think we need to restart a social contract that basically says with any kind of work, whatever the classification, there ought to be benefits. And those benefits ought to start accruing from the first hour that someone works. They should be able to be aggregated across a variety of works, because many people will do a variety of different kind of work, even at the same time, and that those benefits ought to be portable as you move from one job to another or one gig to another. I think we have taken two steps in that direction over the last few years. The ACA, the Affordable Care Act, was a giant step towards healthcare portability and the ability to not have your healthcare tied to your single employer. And then in early on, and I want to give my friend Senator Ron Wyden appropriate credit on this, even in the first CARES Act, as the pandemic burst upon the scene a year ago, we expanded the coverage for unemployment, which prior to the pandemic only covered about 35% of our workforce, because that was the percentage of workers that fit into classic W-2 category. We expanded unemployment insurance underneath the pandemic employment extension to cover gig workers, to cover independent contractors in a way that, while not getting a lot of attention, was a beginnings of a movement towards that portable benefit nature. I think we need to build upon that. We need to make permanent the expansion of unemployment. And we also need to think about how we make all benefits, and we maybe need to rethink what would go into that benefit package that we would create for 21st century training and 21st century working. Second, we've seen also coming out of the pandemic, what I would argue is the pandemic brought about in a single year, 10 years of movements towards a digital economy. We've seen that now in terms of the need for broadband, how that is a economic necessity, not a nice to have at this moment as we study, work, or receive healthcare benefits remotely. We need to make sure broadband becomes ubiquitous. But we've also seen, as we look at a numbers approaching 18 million Americans that are still either out of work or long-term unemployed, that many of the jobs that ultimately over a decade were probably going to be eliminated as we move to a digital economy, they were eliminated during this pandemic year. And while we've started to see unemployment numbers tick a little bit better, I think we need to acknowledge that many of the jobs that disappeared during the pandemic are not coming back. And if there is a single largest failing out of the now six COVID relief bills, close to $5 trillion in relief, is that we have not put near enough resources into the level of retraining and upskilling for those jobs that have been eliminated. And disproportionately, not just through the pandemic, but even since the Great Recession, we have seen three out of the four jobs that have been eliminated have been jobs that were jobs that required high school education or less, and they've all been replaced by jobs that require high school or college degree or more going forward. And we still got a complete mismatch between workers coming out or students coming out of schools being trained for the jobs that are necessary. I would argue, and a big idea that I would hope that Brookings and others could tear apart and maybe make better, is I think we need to dramatically rethink how we invest in human beings. Right now, we have a tax accounting and reporting system, if you're a public company, that favors investment in tangible goods or in research and development over human capital. And let me give you the shorty version here so we can get to the conversation. You know, right now, we have if a company goes out and spends $5,000 on a robot to try to improve production, oftentimes the company receives an R&D tax credit for that robot. The robot is viewed as an asset on your balance sheet. And if you're a public company, you can report that that robot and brag about it. If the same company spends $5,000 and trains two human beings to be more efficient than the robot, you get no tax credit. You do get to expense that, but it's not nearly the same tax benefit. Those training costs are viewed as an expense, and there's no place to report that investment. I think we need to create the equivalent of an R&D tax credit for investment in human beings. I think we need to work with our accounting profession to recognize that investment in human beings ought to be viewed as an asset class, not an expense. And I think we need to build on the work that even the Trump SEC started on to encourage public company reporting on their investment in human capital. This is a big area, a big idea. And again, in our conversation, I hope we can come back. There are a series of smaller ways we could implement that, but I think we have to think on a macro basis. And third, we need to recognize, and I think about this from a lot of the work that we've looked at over the last couple of years, how do we move the basic concept of modern American capitalism back to what I would call stakeholder capitalism over shareholder-only capitalism? In the last 20th century, we've seen the triumph of short-term shareholder returns being more important than any other item. That has become, in a sense, the gospel. I think that is not the capitalism that really existed for some Americans post-World War II. Obviously, post-World War II capitalism disadvantaged Americans of color and women. But there was, for a while, a mantra that said, you can do well by your shareholders and also do well by your employees and your community. We need to get back to that more inclusive capitalism, conscientious capitalism. There's a series of groups that have been advocating this change. I think it could come about by a standardization of standards around what's called ESG, environmental, societal, and governance standards, that those standards ought to be viewed as material. I think increasingly for reporting purposes, I think increasingly employees, customers, and more thoughtful investors are looking for this kind of change. And I believe we need to do all we can to push responsible corporate CEOs into having a more responsible capitalism. So coming out of the pandemic with the American Rescue Plan, there are great things that General Allen indicated, like the child tax credit. We've got to make that permanent. There are immediate assistance to so many Americans who've been challenged and hurt by the pandemic. What we now need to do is build upon that and move to the structural changes. And those structural changes, I would again argue, should be portable benefits, and benefits that can aggregate and go with any type of work, no matter what kind of classification, a complete change in the tax accounting and reporting system for investment in human capital, and a move within the overall structure of capitalism to bring about a more inclusive capitalism that includes all stakeholders, not just shareholders. All of that, I believe, Camille, would lead us to a resurgence of a middle class. And we all obviously have to do this in a way that recognizes that the recovery we've seen so far has been disproportionately benefiting higher income, wider populations, and that I've got a series of other ideas on how we will grapple with some of those disparities, which I hope we can get to in this conversation.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Senator Warner. And I think you've definitely, been very thoughtful about what does this post-pandemic recovery look like? And it sounds like your point of departure is, unless we actually take active steps, we could see inequalities widen. We could see the path to the middle class continue to crumble. And so we have to take affirmative steps that really invest in workers and invest in those opportunities to be able to get to the other side of the pandemic and much later in a way that really benefits middle class families. So with that said, let me start by asking you a question. So we have, I think the point of departure for the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 is basically to stabilize families currently who are really hurting and to provide some level of security for both low income and low middle income families. Given that's sort of the starting point, what do you think are some of the immediate next steps? Obviously, the stimulus package is going to be active for several months, but what do you see as the next immediate steps that link that kind of security blanket, if you want to call it that, with some of the steps that you're talking about that help create, you know, more permanent benefits and help put people onto the path to a middle-class lifestyle via increased training and increased investment in human capital?
Well, Camille, I think you've very accurately described the American Rescue Plan and, frankly, much of the earlier legislation that took place. How do we help people get through the immediate challenge around COVID? How do we make sure we can get you economically back on your feet? But I think we have to acknowledge, and General Allen made mention of this in his opening comments, you know, COVID did not strike all Americans fairly. COVID way disproportionately hurt communities of color. The data on both illness, death rate amongst Black Americans, Brown Americans, much, much higher than the majority community. That has also translated into greater job loss. And that has also translated, I say this as somebody who was an entrepreneur, and you know, again, hopefully an entrepreneur that recognizes I wouldn't have gotten three shots after my first two failed businesses if I was not a white guy, to recognize what COVID also disproportionately hurt with Black and Brown businesses. We've lost 440,000 Black-owned businesses in America in the last year. We've lost close to a third of the Latino businesses have had to shut down. And our rescue, well-intentioned rescue plans to support small businesses candidly exacerbated that problem, at least in the early rounds, because Black-owned and Brown-owned businesses usually have had to bootstrap themselves into existence, didn't have traditional banking relationships. And so consequently, when the first dollars went out under the PPP programs, those businesses did not participate at the same level. Now, good news is there were efforts in the subsequent bills, both the December bill, the bipartisan bill that I helped put together, and the American Rescue Plan to shore that up in terms of trying to target smaller businesses, minority businesses, but again, with mostly stopgap relief. One of the things that didn't get a lot of attention that I was very proud to have gotten in into the December bill was $12 billion to fund Black-owned banks in this country and community development financial institutions. CDFIs, by definition, lend to low-income and low- and moderate-income communities. Oftentimes, those businesses that may not have a traditional banking relationship. We got $12 billion, $3 billion in grants, $9 billion in tier one capital that will go into the CDFIs that will actually increase their lending capacity by about $90 billion. This will increase the capacity of this sector by about 40%. Not a full set solution, but a long-term structural change. If we can combine that along with some of the, frankly, at this point, more advertising than actual works of large banks who are saying they want to lend more to minority business communities. If we can make that real, if we can take some of corporate America who say, in light of the murder of George Floyd and the need to have appropriate levels of racial reconciliation, if we can turn that talk into real tangible dollars, I think one of the things that we should make a top priority on a structural change going forward is increasing equality of access to capital. There are extraordinary, you know, I say this, venture capital has long already been a center, you know, Black and Brown entrepreneurs in this country. What they lack has been a fair access to capital. And when they do build businesses, they have not had traditional banking relationships that allow them to expand at the level commensurate with their skills and their ability. I think this access to capital issue, the structural change we started in December is one, at least for me, probably my top priority on where I want to spend my time. Let's make sure we build out this CDFI MDI initiative. Let's make sure that the corporate entities and others who are talking a good game, that there's some real there, and that this access to capital issue, of which I've been a beneficiary of 35 years ago, has that same kind of fair shot opportunity for all Americans.
No, I think it's important to recognize that that sort of unequal playing field for Black and Brown entrepreneurs versus everyone else. And I think it's important to institutionalize some some elements of the current PPP program and make sure that they really are working for those populations. Beyond that, let me ask you a little bit about paid family leave. I know that, one of the important portions of the stimulus plan is really to the most recent stimulus package is to really try to get people back on their feet. But as we move forward, knowing what we know about how COVID-19 has really hit communities of color, lower income workers, and particularly women, particularly hard, where do you see paid family leave sort of fitting into either the sort of current moment or as we move forward as part of a middle class package?
I think paid family leave has to be a critical component going forward. And we can debate whether it's 10 weeks, 12 weeks, 16 weeks, but we're the only industrial nation in the world that doesn't have paid family leave. And as you mentioned, Camille, not only communities of color, but disproportionately women lost jobs at a much higher rate than their male counterparts. A lot of that as well was due to women that had to then take off from work, because if your school's closed down and your child care center has closed down because of social distancing requirements, women are still disproportionately taking care of our children. So paid family leave needs to be built in. I was proud last year in my role then as vice chairman of the intelligence committee to make sure that our intelligence community in last year's authorization bill got paid family leave, and then it got extended to the balance of the federal workforce. We need to institutionalize this. I think we can do it in a way that is appropriate and affordable. Again, every other industrial nation in the world has this benefit. And I think it, again, builds for stronger opportunity. One thing I would point out in the American Rescue Plan, the Biden stimulus, building on what we did in December, there was a recognition, particularly for child care centers, that if they were going to be able to stay in existence through the balance of COVID, they needed direct federal support, because just the business model, they operate at such thin margins. And if you have to, if you had 30 kids before and now with social distancing, you can only take in 15 kids, but you need the same supervision, you're going to need some help. So I would argue with paid family leave, we need to continue to look at support for child care around this country, so women who choose that want to come back into the workforce, they can.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely important. I know we don't have a lot of time left, but I do want to ask you a question about how we get workers to be much more agile as the economy and as technology changes. And I know that you have thought a lot about how is it that we get the right skill set, we get people to embrace lifelong learning, that we get employers to actually invest in workers. Can you talk a little bit about some of those proposals that are really trying to align worker skill sets with an evolving economy and an evolving technology economy in particular?
Well, McKinsey did very good studies prior to COVID that showed about a third of the work in America, a third of the jobs in America will change by 2030. Doesn't mean they're all going to be replaced, but they're going to change. And my point about moving towards that digital economy, 10 years worth of movement in 1 year brought about by COVID because of this dislocation, gives a real impetus for us to make these kind of changes and investments. So one, I do think at a macro level, if we give companies that invest in their workers a tax credit rather than simply a tax deduction, if we think about investing in human capital as an asset class rather than an expense class, that is the broad-based idea that I think will generate a lot of activity. Again, reminding people that back in the 1970s, the R&D tax credit was viewed as a radical idea fought by the accounting community because they thought it was too squishy. Well, I know there's some questions around training the same way. I think we can figure it out. But we can't just rely only upon the workforce or only upon the employers. I've got also legislation that would create individualized training accounts. I know the Brookings folks have got a similar type where there would be potentially a worker contribution, a employer contribution, and potentially a federal government contribution that would give that worker the flexibility to actually change careers midstream. And you've got to build in both the ability to fund that, but also the time flexibility. And third, I think we need to do a much better job, particularly for mid-career workers, of explaining that, you know, because we're moving into a technology-based workforce does not mean everybody has to become a computer coder. In Southwest Virginia, we've got one of the strongest areas of our coal economy. Many of those jobs have disappeared, but many of the skills you learned as a coal miner, machining skills, dexterity skills, can be used, whether it's on clean energy provisions. We're now trying to build the largest wind turbines off the East Coast, off the coast of Virginia. I think it would be great if those wind turbines were actually made in Appalachia. So working with a workforce that sometimes feels intimidated and feels like everyone going forward is going to require complete computer coding skills is really important. I think about the fact that in Virginia, we have about 42,000 unfilled cybersecurity jobs. About half those jobs only require a two-year degree, not a four-year computer science degree. So I think there is an important education component. What we've lost at times is, you know, whose responsibility is it going to be to educate the workforce about what the jobs, not only in the future decades from now, but the jobs literally coming out of COVID are going to look like? And where are we going to find that funding? That is, again, I would argue, one of the areas we've fallen short of the $5 trillion we've spent. If we put a trillion of that into worker retraining for many of these jobs, particularly in hospitality and otherwise, that might not be coming back, and invested that directly in workers, I think we would have been in a stronger spot going forward.
Well, I know you're going to continue to champion these kinds of proposals. The mark of a good conversation is that it always feels like it ends a little too early. But Senator Warner, I want to thank you for joining us here today. And I do want to invite you again to come back and join us as your proposals continue to evolve. And we would be more than happy to have you back on here as we discuss the future of the middle class. Thanks to everybody for joining us. And
Camille, can I make one last point? One thank you and thank Brookings for the great work you're doing. But I think these ideas, whether we're talking about portable benefits or investment in human capital or more inclusive capitalism in some of these projects, they do also have the opportunity not to fall upon the traditional, you know, conservative versus liberal, left versus right line. These are much more a future versus past conversation. And I think if we can posit them that way, we can find the kind of political willpower across party lines to get this done. And again, commend the great work that you're doing.
Well, excellent. That's a great hopeful note on which to end. Thank you very much, Senator Warner.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Have a nice afternoon.